Well, good afternoon, podcasters. And before we jump into episode 44 of the Banking Litigation Podcast, can I thank you all for your lovely warm comments, feedback and kind words. It's been wonderful to hear them from you, especially when we've met many of you in person. And they're always very welcome. So thank you very much. And here we are back from half term. Hello, co-host Kerry. How are you?
Yeah, I'm well, thanks, John. How are you doing?
I'm very well indeed. I had a lovely half term. Were you away?
No, but my kids were. Oh. They went to their grandparents for a few days.
Is that Terry?
Yeah.
Yes, Kerry and Terry.
So it felt like I had a break because all I had to do was work.
Well, indeed. And me?
And you?
I was in Venice, Kerry. I was in Venice with my family for half term, which is apt because my first case is about Venice. But before we get into that, let me welcome our guest speaker today, Nora van Meervik. I hope I pronounced that correctly, Nora. Nora, it turns out, is multilingual and has warned me she's going to assassinate me if I massacre any of the Italian language pronunciations. But bear with me. But welcome, Nora.
Thank you.
Good. Okay, well, I did say I was going to take us to Venice, so hop in the Vaporetto, because we're about to go and understand a bit more about my first case, Banca Intesa San Paolo and Comune di Venezia. Getting a nod there from Nora. Good. And so this is another of these wonderful cases concerning Italian banks seeking declarations from the English court that certain interest rate swaps entered into with a municipal authority in Italy were valid and binding.
Oh, yes. I believe this is the much anticipated decision, considering the question of capacity in the recent wave of visitors disputes.
That's absolutely right, Kerry. Much anticipated, and it concerns capacity, and it concerns ISDA. So right on three counts. We've covered all the key developments in this line of cases. Indeed, many of our podcasters will remember Scott Warrant's valiant attempts to pronounce Italian case names in the 2022 festive edition of our podcast. It was so impressive that we actually did a bloopers outtake, if you recall. But anyway, if that hasn't jogged your memory, then this is the latest case in a line of authorities looking at swaps transactions entered into by foreign municipal authorities in which those parties have sought to set aside the trades on the basis that they were invalid under mandatory foreign laws applicable to whether the authorities had capacity to enter into those transactions.
And this is a super important point for contracts with Italian municipal authorities because of what some might consider a slightly peculiar Italian Supreme Court decision in the case of Cattolica.
Yes, indeed, Cattolica, Nora, that's absolutely right. The Italian Supreme Court in Cattolica decided in 2020 that a pre-2008 Italian law governed swap between a bank and a local authority was invalid because the transaction contained features which the Italian local authorities were not permitted to agree to. So in the present case, the local authority had relied on Cattolica to argue that the transactions were invalid because the city of Venice had no power to enter into them under Italian law on the basis that they were speculative and involved recourse to indebtedness in breach of the Italian constitution. Now, the High Court, surprisingly perhaps, swayed away from previous English authorities and held that an Italian court would have found the swaps to be void as a result of the restrictions in Cattolica. And so the bank's application seeking declarations that the swaps were valid failed.
And so what did the Court of Appeal decide in this instance, John?
Well, Kerry, the Court of Appeal overturned the High Court's decision, comprehensively rejecting their reasoning. In particular, in this case, an existing interest rate swap had been restructured into a collar, and the negative mark-to-market value is embedded in the new transaction. So since there was no argument that the original swap was speculative, the High Court should have concluded, the Court of Appeal said, that this was hedging and the restructuring could not convert valid hedging into speculation. And secondly, given its conclusion that the original swap was valid hedging, the Court of Appeal said that the negative mark-to-market was an existing exposure faced by Venice. So rolling it over into a restructured swap could not somehow become an upfront payment sufficient to constitute indebtedness.
It sounds like the Court of Appeal's decision is a welcome development for banks, John.
Yes, it is indeed, Nora, both in the context of Italian swaps litigation and for derivatives claims involving allegations of capacity more generally. And indeed, it's been considered and followed by the English court in a subsequent case, and this is when you're going to assassinate me, Banca Nazionale del Lavoro and Provincia di Cantanzoro.
We tried.
There's some pronunciation for you, Scott Warren.
Well, indeed. Look, I think it's worth noting the court's analysis of the correct approach to appeals and findings of foreign law. And I'll read our podcast. I'll leave our podcasters to review that in our blog post at their leisure. Now, the Court of Appeal also gave some helpful guidance in respect of the defences available in response to Venice's counterclaim for restitution of sums paid to the banks under the swap transactions. And it confirmed that in principle, and importantly, a defence of change of position in respect of payments made under back-to-back hedging arrangements was available to the appellant bank on the basis that it had entered into those arrangements in anticipatory reliance on the payments to be made under the transactions. And this finding is of potentially broader significance to banks who typically hedge their market risks of derivative transactions with clients, meaning that even if those transactions are later found to be void, the liability to repay any sums received under the derivatives may be substantially reduced or indeed extinguished.
Well, thank you very much, John. And if any of our listeners would like to delve deeper into this decision, please do let us know. In the meantime, you can read more about the Venezia case in our blog post. There is a link in the show notes.
Thank you, Kerry. Let's turn now off the Grand Canal, down an alleyway in the Vaporetto, onto Nora, who is a duo of some sanctions cases for our next section.
Thanks, John. Yes, today I have picked out two interesting examples of how global sanction regimes are challenging for financial institutions to navigate. Firstly, I will be unpacking the case of European Union against the Syrian Arab Republic, where the High Court allowed a summary judgment application by a lender and guarantor against a borrower for defaulted loan payments.
And sticking to the theme, I'm going to take a wild guess and assume the defence relied on sanctions as a barrier to make payment.
Exactly right, Kerry. The borrower attempted to rely on EU sanctions and argued that the imposition of these sanctions rendered further payments under the loan agreements unlawful, and so the contract was unenforceable under the so-called Riley-Bross doctrine. However, the court did not agree with this. It highlighted that the borrower failed to demonstrate it had made reasonable efforts to apply for a license to make payment from the relevant EU sanctions authority, which could have enabled the borrower to make payments legally.
So does that mean, Nora, that we now have clear guidance on which party has the burden of proving that payment under a contract would result in a breach of sanctions?
We do indeed, John. The court clarified that the burden rests on the debtor to prove that they couldn't legally make payment under the foreign law because of sanctions. And because a contract can be legally performed where the relevant sanctions regime contains a dispensation provision, this means the debtor will have the responsibility of proving that they could not get a license from the responsible sanctions authority. In the present case, the borrower's failure to present evidence or attempt to meet this burden therefore worked against their defense, as they were not able to show that attempts were made to apply for a license to make a payment, or alternatively, to prove that, even had such efforts been made, a license would actually have been refused.
So I think drawing this together, diligence and active engagement with the relevant authorities is needed in navigating international sanctions regimes. And to delve further into this web of complexities, I think you have another sanctions case for us, Nora, this one focusing on sanctions imposed on Russia.
I sure do, John. My second case is Litasco against their Mond Oil and Gas Africa. This case involved the claimant Swiss oil trading company, owned by a Russian parent, which entered into a contract to supply crude oil to the defendant Senegalese company. Following the defendant's default in making contractual payments and the subsequent introduction of Russian sanctions in the UK, the claimant accelerated the debt and demanded the outstanding balance from the defendant. The claimant commenced proceedings and brought a summary judgment application, which the Senegalese company defended on a number of bases, including a change in sanctions clause and force majeure clause.
Could you elaborate on what the court decided on the force majeure defence, please, Nora?
Absolutely. The defendants argued that the force majeure clause was engaged, adducing evidence of five African banks who were unwilling to make payments to the claimant because of sanctions concerns. However, the court disagreed, emphasizing that the inability to pay stemmed from currency shortages as a result of the Russia-Ukraine war and not directly from sanctions.
That's very interesting. I think there was some commentary on the wording of this force majeure clause in this case, because it didn't require a force majeure event amounting to an outright prevention, but it also extended to a situation where there was a hindrance or a delay, which is quite broad for a force majeure clause.
Well, John, the court clarified that prevention implies rendering performance impossible, whereas hindrance suggests making performance more difficult, but not impossible. However, where we are looking at the situation of a seller who has done everything they need to do to receive payment, the court stressed that a force majeure clause, including the hindering wording, would be difficult to engage. To suspend performance in these circumstances, the paying party would need to demonstrate a significant degree of difficulty, perhaps one approaching impossibility.
I see. Okay. So thank you for that clarification, Nora. Now, what about the reliance on the change in sanctions clause?
So, John, the defendants sought to rely on a change in sanctions clause, which provided that the payment obligations under the agreement could be suspended where a change in applicable sanctions regimes resulted in the risk of penalty for complying with such obligations. The court, however, found that the clause wasn't applicable, as it was intended to cover the situation where sanctions were introduced, which directly affected the parties of the transactions, which wasn't the case here. The court rejected the argument that the claimant, though not designated itself, was indirectly controlled by a designated party. In this instance, Mr. Putin, by applying the ownership and control test under the UK sanctions regime.
Now, this is a very important point, which I know has been of interest to a number of our client banks because of the problematic obiter comments made by the Court of Appeal regarding the ownership and control test in Mintz and PJSC. So how did the court interpret the test in this case?
You're quite right, John. The test concerns the circumstances in which companies which are not themselves listed as designated persons must be treated as subject to sanctions restrictions on the basis of their ownership or control by a designated person. And in the present case, the court held that the test requires an existing influence by a designated person over the relevant affairs of the company, not just one they may be in a position to bring about. So while Mr. Putin could arguably put all of the company's assets under his control, this alone did not suffice.
Thank you for this whistle-stop tour on the latest in the global sanctions space, Nora. And if any of our listeners would like to know more on these decisions, please find a link to both of our blog posts in the show notes, or do feel free to get in touch.
Now, Kerry, Nora and I have got ourselves comfortably ensconced in Harry's bar. I think it's your turn while we sit here with our Bellinis. For you to take us through a topical issue in the class actions realm, the representative action procedure, with not one, not two, but three decisions.
Yeah, thanks, Fire John. Maybe we'll book a different meeting room next time at Harry's Bar. Lots of riveting legal analysis for our listeners so early on in the week, but not to fret, I'll do my best to be brief and not to get carried away.
I think Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart are standing at the door waiting for their shot, so please do fire on.
Very good, John. To the next performance of the Bank Litigation podcast will be at the O2, maybe.
Well, maybe we will with our fellow influencers.
Yes. Yeah, might be a slightly smaller venue. So to start off, we've got the Court of Appeal's decision in Commission Recovery and Marks and Clark, confirming that a secret commission claim could proceed as an opt-out representative action under CPR 19.8.
And just to clarify, Kerry, what exactly do we mean by opt-out representative action in this context?
Well, Nora, under CPR 90.8, a claim can be brought by a party as a representative of any other persons with the same interest in the claim on an opt-out basis, with no requirement to identify the represented parties or to join them to the action, but any judgment will be binding on them.
This procedural mechanism sounds like it could increase the litigation risks for financial institutions.
Yeah, quite right, Nora. So banks are a natural target defendant for class actions. So staying on top of procedural developments in this area is key, particularly because there's a trend for claimants to look for innovative procedural rules to bring class action decisions on an opt-out basis, as doing so will inevitably reduce the time, effort and costs of building a book of class action claimants. So, very briefly on the procedural chronology in Marks and Clark, the claimant has alleged that the defendant, a patent and trademark firm, received secret commissions for referring clients to a third-party provider of IP renewal services. The claimant issued the proceedings as a representative under CPR 19.8 on behalf of current and former clients of the defendant. The defendant, however, applied to strike out the claim on the grounds that the same interest requirement for a representative action has not been met.
Now, I could be misremembering, Kerry, but I seem to recall that the High Court adopted a very liberal approach to the same interest requirement in this case.
Yes, that's right. And so although the Court of Appeal has upheld the High Court's decision and given the green light for the claim to proceed as an opt-out representative action, it has confirmed that only issues that are truly common to the class can proceed under CPR 19.8.
So what did the Court of Appeal hone in on as the common issue here?
Well, the decision suggests that the only common issue is whether the claimant is correct that class members will establish liability if they prove merely that they contracted with the defendant on standard terms and the defendant received relevant renewal commissions. This can be contrasted with the defendant's position that the scope and content of its duty depends on the particular circumstances of its retainer with each individual client.
That sounds like a very narrow issue.
Yes, quite right. And so even, interestingly, even if the claimant succeeds in obtaining this declaration, it will not amount to a decision on liability in any individual case, in particular because the court will need to consider potential defences of disclosure, informed consent and limitation. And this means that there'll be a bifurcated approach to the claim in which the court will have to address common issues at an initial first stage with individual issues left to be determined at a later stage.
Sounds slightly wasteful, but if memory serves me correctly, Kerry, I believe that this bifurcated process was the brainchild of Lord Leggett in Lloyd and Google and is still a very novel approach.
Yes, that's right, John. So it was very recently first adopted in Barclays Bank and Terry.
Not Kerry.
And not Kerry, and not also not my dad in this instance, thankfully, for which, thank you for this, I was going to say seamless transition, feels slightly less seamless now, because that is in fact my next case. So in Barclays Bank and Terry, we have the reverse use of the representative action procedure in comparison to what we typically see in banking litigation cases. Here, Barclays brought the claim against two representative defendants under CPR 19.8 as representatives of around 5,000 other individual defendants. All of the defendants represented took out mortgages with the bank, but these were discharged by mistake, even though not fully repaid. And so the bank sought rescission of the discharge. The bank applied for summary judgment on the basis that the defendants had no real prospect of successfully defending the claim. The court was satisfied that the discharge of the mortgages resulted in from a distinct mistake on the part of the bank. So the court's jurisdiction to reverse the transaction was engaged for all of the represented defendants. However, in order to grant relief, the court had to consider a second stage, and that was whether the mistake was sufficiently serious to make it unconscionable for the customers to retain the benefit. In relation to the two named defendants, the judge was satisfied on the unconscionability point and granted summary judgment. However, in respect of the represented defendants, the court could not make the same decision because it was necessary to look at the facts of their cases to determine the question of unconscionability.
So this would then have to be addressed at the second stage of the bifurcated procedure, bringing Lord Leggett's vision to life.
Yes, an interesting turn of events indeed. However, a different outcome was reached in the case of Wirral Council and Invideor.
Yes, correct again, John, yet again beating me to the punch. So in this case, the claimant local authority sought to use the representative action procedure in the context of a Section 1990A FSMA claim against the defendant listed issuer. In a nutshell, the allegations are that certain statements made to the market about the marketing of the company's opioid addiction drug were misleading and that there's a claim for prospectus liability based on essentially the same facts. This is a group claim on behalf of investors who have all signed up to a cost-sharing governance agreement. So this means that all of the claimants have actually been identified to the defendants already.
So the claim is proceeding on an opt-in basis. So why was the claimant seeking to use the representative action machinery?
Well, rather controversially, this was an attempt by the claimant to take advantage of the bifurcated process and seek declarations on the defendant side issues only, such as whether the defendants had published untrue or misleading statements to the market. The declaration sought did not include so-called claimant side issues, such as standing to sue, reliance, causation and quantum.
Wouldn't that have put all the burden on the defendants for the first stage of the process if it had been allowed to proceed?
Yes, with the claimants avoiding spending time and money developing their case on the claimant side issues until the later stage. As you can imagine, the court did not take well to this approach and refused to allow the claim to proceed on this basis. Instead, the court found that ordinary multi-party proceedings should be pursued and was pretty robust in its explanation as to why it is up to the judge managing claims to consider which issues should be progressed at which stage.
Welcome news for would-be defendants, particularly in a securities class action context.
Quite right, John. It suggests that claimants will not be permitted to use CPR 19.8 to gain a tactical advantage as to how a class action will be managed. And the proper split of issues in every case will be for the court to consider in exercising its case management powers.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Kerry. And I believe we have blog posts on all three of these decisions.
We do, John. We've been very busy. The links are all in the show notes. Now, to quickly round off our segment with John covering our final case.
Yes, thank you, Kerry. I will run briefly through the judgment in Bars and Saudi National Bank, in which the Supreme Court unanimously dismissed a claim in knowing receipt against the bank.
A common cause of action against banks, so this must be a welcome clarification on the legal requirements from the highest court.
Absolutely, Nora. The facts of this case are quite complex, though, and I'm conscious of time. Hush, Alistair. So I would recommend reading our blog post to any podcasters out there who are dealing with a knowing receipt claim at the moment, or if you're just curious, there is, of course, a link in the show notes. But in terms of the most important points of clarification from the Supreme Court, I'll highlight two for you. First, the judgment confirms that a claimant must hold an equitable interest in the property in question at the time of the defendant's knowing receipt or alleged knowing receipt. This is the case even if the defendant clearly knew that the transfer was in breach of trust. And secondly, and probably most importantly for this type of case that we deal with, the court confirmed that the knowledge requirement of the cause of action cannot be satisfied by mere notice. Likewise, knowledge will not be satisfied simply because it would be unconscionable for the recipient to retain the benefit of the property received.
Although this guidance from the Supreme Court is helpful, John, I believe it does still leave a number of important elements of knowing receipt claims unresolved.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Nora. We still require subsequent court guidance on the precise test for knowledge in knowing receipt claims. And it's probably a bit of a pity that the Supreme Court declined to reach a conclusion as to whether constructive knowledge would be sufficient. But there's all the more fodder as a result of that to cover in future podcast episodes. So wrapping up, now we're back into St Mark's Square. Thank you very much indeed, Nora, for swinging by today and helping us out. Kerry, co-host, as ever, thank you very much. Podcasters, thank you to all of you for listening. Like, share, subscribe. And Nora, thank you very much for bringing it all together. And see you soon.